The Indignities of Being a Woman by Meryl Marco and Megan Keister.
The Indignities of Being a Woman. Enslaved the sheep who oversees the cradle, the ladle, the broom. The atrocities of history belong to those unfortunately born to be a man with a womb.
Man with a womb.
Va, 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 boom!
Hi, I'm Meryl Marco, and I have been a woman for over six decades. This makes me an expert in the fast-growing, high-paying field of observable gender politics.
And I'm Megan Keister, a perpetually underpaid millennial whose infertility is her retirement plan. Stop as if you've heard this before, but it is, and always has been, hard to be a woman.
When you stop to think about it, even here in the fancy-schmancy United States of America, it took 140 years after the Declaration of Independence for women to be granted the right to vote. You know, it only took 79 years in Saudi Arabia, a place where women just got the right to drive.
Yeah, there are one metric fuckton of ways in which the system has been constructed against us. From trying to lean in while knowing the Equal Rights Amendment never passed, to having every single thing you write online mansplained by a stranger, being a woman continues to be an exercise in frustrating debasement.
So what we're going to do here is examine what it's like to be a woman in 2018 when you're constantly being told equality between the sexes exists, but reality proves otherwise. We're intending to take a broader look on how far we've come and sort of try and answer the question, do we have it better now or do we have it worse?
And considering women are 51% of the population, how can we still be fighting for equal rights after 7,000 years of recorded civilization? And how did all this bullshit start anyway? Welcome to the Indignities of Being a Woman. Our first topic, inequality, which is a broad subject, both literally and figuratively.
The game plan is this. I'm going to discuss the historical past through 1900. Megan is going to do the 20th and the 21st centuries. Which reminds me, we should probably give the disclaimer.
Oh, about how we're by no means licensed historians and that the story of women's existence throughout, I don't know, all of fucking time is far too exhaustive and exhausting to completely cover in 12 little chapters?
Yeah, that's more or less what I mean. The stuff we're talking about here is all true. It all happened. And in fact, we checked everything as carefully as we could. But if you feel some of the details are off, well, this isn't a course for college credit. No one will get a grade, so neither of us is going to be insulted if you keep your corrections about how it wasn't 450 BC, it was 425 BC to yourself.
We want to say we're sorry for not covering everything, but we're also aware of the inherent problem that lies in the fact that, as women, we've been raised to apologize for our very existence, so...
Here's the thing. When I was a kid, I learned about opera and Igor Stravinsky from watching Bugs Bunny. So I guess what we're saying is, let us be your Bugs Bunny, which means don't bombard us on Twitter if we don't mention your favorite indignity against women.
What kind of a person has a favorite indignity against women?
Trump, probably.
Well, which Trump?
All of them.
Even Tiffany?
Especially Tiffany. When I was a naive, young, addle-pated art student in college, I just accepted that 99% of the artists we were studying were men. I didn't analyze classroom content that way, any more than I would have questioned whether there were too many repeating numbers in the equations in an algebra class. It never occurred to me that written history was describing a place where women had been systematically prevented from getting into the game because, come on, it was almost the 70s, and a woman could do whatever she damn well wanted because, well, who's going to stop her? Was I an idiot or what? Lately, watching the women around me finally speaking up about being routinely hammered over the head in an endless variety of ways, I started wondering, why exactly did women wind up with fewer rights? Considering we're 51% of the population, how did the odds always end up so stacked against us? Is it because human men are just genetically predisposed to pathological bullying, like, say, the alpha in a troop of chimpanzees, and therefore unable to prevent themselves from hurling fistfuls of feces at their fellow chimps? And I think I have good news. It seems like this behavior is kind of a new trend. Of course, by new, I mean it's been going on for thousands of years. But don't forget, planet Earth is 4.5 billion years old. The original recipe prehistoric hunter-gatherer societies accounted for about 90% of the 7 million years of known human activity. And it appears they were far more egalitarian than the bigger, crazier cultures that eventually engulfed them. So I have my fingers crossed that all the pathologically vindictive behavior we're about to describe in this book isn't actually coded into the human male DNA, like eating your own mother is for a male crab spider. Though, credit where credit is due, these darn human men really went the distance in terms of diligently cramming hundreds of civilizations worth of crazy into the last 5 or 6,000 years. Even if thinking your own mother was an entree wasn't a regular part of it. As far as I can tell, the bullshit begins around 3000 BC, when men decided to make everyone stop tracing their family lineage through the mother, which is how it always used to be done because, well, when you see a baby surrounded by placenta emerging from between the legs of a woman during childbirth, it's pretty common to conclude, you know, I get the feeling those two are related. Apparently, this made men feel left out because in many cultures, they decided it'd be better to trace the family lineage through the father instead. A great idea, unless the recent dating habits of the mother were an unknown variable, in which case the identity of the father might be up for grabs. Eventually, this led paranoid men, eager to build a dynasty, to start monitoring the behavior of women. And the fastest way to do this was to find ways to redefine them as your property, which is always a bad category, even for a vacant lot. So come with me now on a little time machine journey through the cliff notes of history as we take a quick look at thousands of years of women living life as someone's property. First stop, Mesopotamia, 3000 BC, the beginning of written history, and a time when male domination really picked up some steam. After taking a little time out to invent the wheel, mathematics, astronomy, agriculture, the men carefully carved out ground zero in the How Long Have Men Been Treating Women Like Shit sweepstakes in an ironically named state called Lagash, now Iraq. Welcome to the first known gender-specific law, adultery. You might think adultery would be a gender free-for-all, fun for every member of the family because, well, it generally is. But a king named Urukagina, who felt he was divinely appointed by God because, of course he was, so many of the ancient misogynists were direct descendants of God. Anyway, he distinguished himself from God's other misogynistic relatives by defining adultery as a capital crime that only a woman could commit. At last, a crime of her own. Imagine the cheering from men when they realized they were totally off the hook. If you were a man in 3000 BC, what went on in Lagash stayed in Lagash. But hey, you can't stop progress. So 500 years later, nothing really improved. In India, land of enlightenment, birthplace of yoga, the Indian holy text called the Vedas required all women to cast down thine eyes and not look up. And this was before they could use the excuse they were texting. Don't worry, though. Around the same time, our good friend Hammurabi, king of Babylon, famous for his philosophy of an eye for an eye, started updating the legal system. So he decreed that women could now be punished not only for their own wrongdoing, but also for crimes committed by their relatives. If Donald Trump ever finds out about the concept of history, he's going to be kicking himself for not having invented this one. Hammurabi offered plenty of examples in order to make sure what he wrote was sufficiently unfair. Like, if a man forcibly rapes a maiden who is residing in her father's house, the father of the maiden shall take the wife of the rapist and give her over to be raped. Then he shall take her for himself. So, see? The old eye for an eye thing working like clockwork. Except that all the eyes are located in the head of some guy's wife who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But, you know, I guess she had it coming to her by letting her father force her to marry a rapist. Jumping ahead another 400 years to 1300 BC, things started really looking up for women. When the good men of the state of Assyria, then the cultural showplace of this area, decided to move the chess pieces forward again by making it legal for Assyrian men to buy, sell, torture, or kill the women in their lives, which I guess was the original version of that fuck, marry, kill game, only so much more invigorating. By then, owning a wife was kind of like having a high-yield treasury bond, since she could easily be sold into marriage, slavery, or prostitution anytime a man was short on money for his poker game. If there had been an Assyrian eBay, the women for sale section would have been massive. Now add to this the great Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser, helping to refine things further by adding that a man may whip his wife, pluck out her hair, mutilate her ears, or strike her. It bears no penalty. Though even he had his limits. If a husband wanted to tear out his wife's breasts or dismember her, he couldn't just randomly do it. He had to consider the entertainment needs of his fellow Assyrians and do it in public. But time marches on, and 900 years later, in ancient China, the emergence of Confucianism ushered in a whole new philosophy about the essence of humanity. So the millions of followers of Confucius, who, by the way, famously said, "A good woman is an illiterate one," eagerly studied this detailed advice written for the ladies. By the way, perfect for crocheting onto a potholder. When walking, don't turn your head. When talking, don't open your mouth wide. When sitting, don't move your knees. When standing, don't rustle your skirts. When happy, don't exult with loud laughter. When angry, don't raise your voice. If you have to go outside, cover your face. Conceal yourself as much as possible. Establish your proper self so as to become a true human being. One who, all her friends are saying, seems to be doing so well after her recent lobotomy. Hopping over to another continent, let's stop in on that legendary seat of democracy, the height of human achievement in the arts, ancient classical Greece, where one might assume that women were finally being appreciated, until you realize they weren't even allowed to be citizens. Or you read the glorious words of the father of Western philosophy, Aristotle, a font of profound insights into women, who said, among other things in the 4th century, "The female is, as it were, a mutilated male, more apt to scold and to strike, more void of shame or self-respect, more false of speech, more deceptive, more difficult to rouse to action, more prone to despondency, and less hopeful." Oh, for God's sakes, buck up, ladies. You live in classical Greece, and just because Aristotle labeled you the inferior sex and holds you responsible for all the world's imperfection is no reason to be despondent or less hopeful. After all, there's still Plato, founder of the first institution of learning in the Western world, which is a pretty good credit on anyone's IMDb, who bothered to add in his most famous work, The Republic, "The relationship of male to female is by nature a relation of superior to inferior, and ruler to ruled." Though I'm partial to his sarcastic comments about the pitfalls of offering women more rights. "If women are to have the same duties as men," he said, I bet with a sly, knowing grin, "then women must be taught music and gymnastics and the art of war, which they must practice like the men, yes? And a ridiculous thing of all will be the sight of women naked in the gym exercising with the men, especially when they're no longer young. They certainly will not be a vision of beauty." You know, if there were any justice in this world, someone would have invented a time machine by now so I could treat Plato to a membership at my gym, because I truly believe that once he got an eyeful of the pure poetry that is me up to speed on the elliptical, he might just change his tune. Plus, imagine his great relief when he sees I never exercise nude. But the truth is, these ideas were of a piece with the rest of that gosh darn classical Athens. As Pericles, dubbed the first citizen of Athens, advised his fellow male citizens, "The greatest glory will be hers who is least talked of among the men, whether for good or for bad." Soak that up, ladies. Of all the fairest princesses in the kingdom, you, my lovely, are the least talked about of them all. On to the glory that was Rome, where you can't help but notice how the myths and legends are chock full of fun rapes. Apparently, mastering rape was a basic requirement for godding. Also, they meant rape in the sense of an abduction, followed by what they referred to as consensual lovemaking. Because, as we all know, once you've been abducted, everything from that point on definitely falls into the category of consensual. Rome, where a gal couldn't vote or own property or hold public office because she was only subject to the laws of her father, whoever the hell he happened to be. But that usually worked out great because she didn't see much of him anyway, since at the age of 7, a daughter could be married off by her father to any man to whom he owed money. And what little 7-year-old girl doesn't dream of that? Also, in the event of a rape, a woman would be forced to marry her rapist to protect her father's good name. A perfect solution, because what father doesn't eagerly look forward to the day when he can walk his little girl down the aisle and hand her off to a rapist? Rape was considered a capital crime, but technically speaking, it could only be committed against a citizen in good standing, which is why the rape of a slave was prosecuted as property damage. And if a woman was a prostitute or an entertainer, such as an actress, a dancer, or a musician, who were all considered disreputable because they made their bodies publicly available, well, that meant that they got no legal protection from sexual abuse or physical violence, period. Cicero, a renowned first-century lawyer, famously defended a client who participated in the gang rape of an actress on the grounds that reasonable young men weren't wrong to expect, in the words of our president, to grab an actress by the pussy. Poor Harvey Weinstein, clearly born at the wrong time. I hope his law team knows that part of his defense should be, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I was confused. I thought I was living in 63 BC. Anyway, shenanigans like these were just some of the reasons why the Romans felt a woman required a male guardian at all times. To quote Cato the Censor, the husband is the judge of his wife. If she has drunk wine, he condemns her. If she has committed adultery, he kills her. Fair enough. Skipping ahead to medieval Europe, in what's called the early modern period, we find that wife battering was not only perfectly legal, it was so popular it hung on for hundreds of years. But finally, starting in the Middle Ages, voices of some rebellious women start to make their way into recorded history for the first time. Thank God. They took the form of secret pop songs embraced by the lower classes in Europe about husbands who were bad, violent, ugly, avaricious, stinking, and old. "Why does my husband beat me?" goes one of them. "I'll make a cuckold of him. I'll go sleep completely naked with my friend." Kind of a relief to read that at least her stinky old husband did allow her to have friends. Meanwhile, back in China, during the Ming Dynasty, there was a popular saying that went, "Only the virtuous man is talented. Only the untalented woman is virtuous." Which makes a lot of sense as long as you define virtuous as meaning hollow-eyed and sunk in a deep depression. Bringing us to a little thing called the Renaissance, beloved for its era of great advancement in art. Well, in men's art, because women were still considered inferior and discouraged from participating in the manly art of painting. And we haven't even gotten to the barrel of laughs known as the witch trials, which took place in many more locations than that famous one in Salem. In early modern Europe, an estimated 40 to 60,000 women were burned alive in one century for appearing to be off-brand. Like how? Well, for instance, being middle-aged and married, but without children. I would have spent that entire period surrounded by kindling. But don't despair. Right around the corner was the Age of Enlightenment and Reason in the 18th century, with its famous salons, run by wealthy, intelligent women who no doubt labored for weeks baking pedicures, polishing wine glasses, and making sure the drawing room was picture perfect for an evening of listening to esteemed male philosophers debate whether women had souls or should be allowed to get an education. Preeminent philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau is often credited with one of the more enlightened views of human equality. But he said this without a trace of irony. "The education of women ought to be relative to men, to please them, to be useful to them, to make themselves loved and honored by them, to educate them when young, to care for them when grown, to counsel them, to console them, and to make life agreeable and sweet to them. These are the duties of women at all times and should be taught to them from their infancy." Excuse me while I take a screen break. Ah, refreshing. The good news is that female authors began to emerge during this period, probably catapulted to the surface by their boiling blood. In 1792, one of my favorite early feminists, Mary Wollstonecraft, debated Rousseau in her book, A Vindication of the Rights of Women, in which she proposed the almost science fiction-like theory that women were actually human beings capable of receiving any damn education they wanted. And we haven't even gotten to 1787 when the American Constitution was ratified, but excluded slaves and, here's a surprise, women of all classes. You know, considering the fact that researchers at UC Berkeley, who studied mitochondrial DNA from 147 people from all over the world, recently determined we are all descended from the same woman. That woman is lucky she's dead, so she'll never have to attend a family reunion and come face to face with the behavior of some of her lunatic sons.
So, hunter-gatherer societies account for 90% of the 7 million years of known human activity, and we're more egalitarian. More like make America egalitarian again, you know what I'm saying? I mean, let's make the continent of North America the way it was before, you know, like Manifest Destiny and shit.
You know, I love how we were taught Manifest Destiny in school, like it's a thing you can just do, just expand westward, just go ahead, fine.
Go west, any man.
Now it would be go west, young software entrepreneur, because you'd have to have that kind of money to buy at the beach.
The Vedas required all women to cast down their eyes and not look up, but here's a question. What if they needed to get a pot off a high shelf? Do they just, like, pull the hem of their husband's garment and gesticulate toward it, or...?
No, it's a little-known fact that they used a series of mirrors, hoists, and pulleys that they had set up all over the house so that they could do that.
Well, multiple mirrors, that's upskirt possibilities at go-go.
No, you're wrong, because, oddly enough, since they had their eyes cast down, they would be able to see that you were doing that and they could stop you.
They couldn't stop you. They had no rights.
Oh, that's right. Okay. All right. You win.
I always do. So you could be burned alive in early modern Europe for being childless? It's the first time I've ever seen my infertility as anything other than a win.
I am stunned by the amount of reasons I could be burned alive. I pretty much from waking up in the morning until going to bed at night, there were reasons that I do every single day that I would have been burned alive. They might as well. I should have just lived with my pockets full of kindling.
I spent election night 2016 surrounded by a group of women who had been similarly raised. Women who assumed the strong, capable candidate who had devoted her life to public service would defeat her comically inexperienced, failed steak salesman opponent. We all know how that turned out. Assuming, in this regard, made an ass out of you, me, and every other woman in America. The election of Donald Trump was a lesson in the fact that, despite what my generation had been raised to believe, the fight was not over. We weren't yet equal. But what did we expect? The list of inequalities women have suffered in the past two centuries is longer than the list of reasons a male member of the Democratic Socialists of America would give us as to why Bernie would have won. We haven't even been allowed to vote for 100 years, for Gaia's sake. The 19th Amendment wasn't ratified until 1920. A year later, the Equal Rights Amendment, designed to ensure women were afforded the same rights as men and, as the name would imply, make us equal, was introduced to Congress. Despite the fact that it's been reintroduced year after year for decades, it's never been ratified. While the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was written in 1948, declares, quote, all human beings, regardless of race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status, are born free and equal in dignity and rights, it's more a suggestion than a rule, as it isn't legally binding. It's literally a declaration of principles countries could take or leave. Indeed, the U.S. delegation to the U.N. the year it was drafted was warned by the State Department to avoid any language that might make them actually have to implement it. The U.N. Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women in 1979 resulted in an international treaty adopted by the General Assembly, which America signed but didn't ratify. You want to know who did ratify it? Fucking Russia. Only six countries, Iran, Palau, Somalia, Sudan, Tonga, and the United States, didn't. In the early 1960s, in an attempt to bury the ERA, the head of the Department of Labor Women's Bureau proposed a special Presidential Commission on the Status of Women, designed to make women's lives better without having to go to the trouble of passing a pesky constitutional amendment. Thoughtful, no? In a televised discussion with the commission's chairwoman, Eleanor Roosevelt, then-president-slash-feminist icon John F. Kennedy stated, we want to be sure that women are used as effectively as they can to provide a better life for our people, in addition to meeting their primary responsibility, which is in the home. The commission ended up issuing a lame, powerless report that was quickly ignored in light of Kennedy's assassination a few days after its release. The passage of the Equal Pay Act in 1963, which mandated equal pay for men and women who performed the same jobs, seemed like a victory. But when you consider the fact that men and women often didn't have the same jobs, as labor was heavily gendered at the time, you can see how empty the gesture was. Meanwhile, the Civil Rights Act was moving its way through Congress. Its most controversial section, Title VII, prohibited racial discrimination in employment. When the act came up for vote in the House, Howard Smith, the racist representative from Virginia, added an amendment which included women as a protected class of Title VII in an attempt to sabotage it. The response from his fellow reps was literal laughter. The act ended up passing anyway, but when it came to women's equality, it wasn't taken seriously. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission was set up to arbitrate complaints under the act. The sole woman on said commission said her fellow members responded to complaints about gender discrimination with, quote, boredom or virulent hostility. The EEOC ruled that help wanted ads couldn't discriminate racially, but did nothing to stop newspapers from separating ads into help wanted male and help wanted female. The fights for women's equality and racial equality have always gone hand in hand. The abolitionist movement was the first issue that politically motivated large numbers of women, as many saw parallels between the treatment of African Americans and themselves. Which is not to say the two groups worked in perfect harmony. At the 1913 Woman's Suffrage Procession in Washington, suffragette Alice Paul made African Americans march at the end of the line so as not to alienate Southern supporters, and in the process proved that rich, white lady feminism has suffered from an embarrassingly problematic lack of intersectionality from jump. The black journalist Ida B. Wells refused to stand in the rear. By marching with the all-white procession of her adopted state of Indiana, she successfully integrated the damn thing. But black women were used to taking initiative. The Montgomery bus boycott, which kicked off the modern civil rights movement, was started by black women, who had spent almost 9 years preparing for it. More radical than the male ministers who acted as the face of the movement, they wanted total integration, not the more orderly system of segregation their male counterparts had been pushing for. Yet black women were almost completely absent from the March on Washington. Only one was on the 19-person planning committee, and female civil rights leaders like Rosa Parks were assigned to march with the wives of male leaders. Zero women were invited to the meeting President Kennedy held with leaders after the march, and A. Philip Randolph, one of its chief organizers, gave his major address at the National Press Club, which barred women from both being members and from being even in attendance as members of the press. Even in the black civil rights movement, women weren't given equal rights. Ain't that some shit? And since we're on the subject of inequality within equality movements, let us now focus on lesbians. Many second-wave women's libbers felt that being a lesbian and a feminist discredited the cause, as feminists were routinely dismissed by mouth-breathers as sapphic separatists. Betty Friedan, the founder of the National Organization of Women, called lesbians the Lavender Menace. In her autobiography, she suggested that, quote, radical fringe lesbians in the women's movement were agent provocateurs planted to try and drag it down. Right. Quoth my girl, former Secretary of State Mattie Albright, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. Wait, did I just imply Betty Friedan is in hell? It's better than Peoria. Speaking of female politicians, America saw its first female state senator in 1896 and its first congresswoman, Montana's Jeanette Rankin, in 1916. A pacifist, she was in office for only 4 days when she voted no against America's entrance into World War I. The vote cost her her seat. It took 2 decades for her to be voted back into office. She was reelected in 1941, right before the attack on Pearl Harbor. The only member of the House to vote against entering World War II, that second nay ended her political career. While some were elected, many of the earliest women to hold office succeeded their dead husbands and were intended to act as placeholders until men were voted in. Today, women make up 19.6% of members of Congress, which makes the U.S. 100th worldwide in terms of female representation in government. Hear that, ladies? We're number one! We're number one! 100! Rwanda's number one, actually. Yeah, that Rwanda. And Saudi Arabia's 98. Kazakhstan, home of the fictional character of Borat, is 58, which must be nice. Throughout American history, the best way to get into politics was to practice law. For the majority of America's existence, however, law and medical schools banned women or limited their numbers to a handful. The Ivy Leagues were impenetrable. Yale and Princeton didn't accept female students until 1969, and Harvard didn't admit them until 1977. In 1869, Myra Bradwell applied to the Illinois Supreme Court in an attempt to become the first woman in the U.S. to practice law. When her application was rejected, she took her case to the Supreme Court, which upheld the decision, saying, quote, "The natural and proper timidity and delicacy which belongs to the female sex evidently unfits it for many of the occupations of civil life. The constitution of the family organization, which is founded in the divine ordinance, as well as the nature of things, indicates the domestic sphere as that which properly belongs to the domain and function of womanhood." Not only could women not practice law, they were also barred from serving on juries in many states. Under English common law, on which early American law was based, women were deemed unfit to serve on juries under the doctrine of proper defectum sexus, which translated means a defect of sex. In 1879, the Supreme Court confirmed states could constitutionally confine the selection of jurors to males, a decision they upheld in 1961, stating, "Despite the enlightened emancipation of women from the restrictions and protections of bygone years, and their entry into many parts of community life formerly considered to be reserved to men, woman is still regarded as the center of home and family life." It wasn't until 1994 that the Supreme Court ruled lawyers couldn't exclude people from jury selection based on their gender. In 1960, there was only one woman in the House with a law degree, Michigan's Martha Griffiths, who told an interviewer, "If there was any question that my career was interfering with my husband's happiness and I had to make a choice, I would definitely give up my career." Hey, but you know what they say, career-oriented wife, unhappy life. Am I right, fellas? If you were a woman who went to college, the dream was to find a guy who could provide for you so you never had to actually use your degree. The male, naturally, president of the all-female college Radcliffe told freshmen their education would prepare them to be splendid wives and mothers, and their reward might be to marry Harvard men. According to Harper's Magazine, quote, "A girl who got as far as her junior year in college without having acquired a man was thought to be in grave danger of becoming an old maid." Today, more women than men enroll in and complete college. As of 2013, women earned 57% of bachelor's degrees and 61% of associate's degrees. Despite these gains, they still earn less than men. In the 1960s, it was around 60%, and today it's around 80%. Which leads us to work. The colonial farm wife had a great deal of status in the family, as she made many things they needed. When the 19th century Industrial Revolution hit and men started working outside the home, however, she lost that status, as America quickly became a society that didn't take anyone without a paying job seriously. Just because you had one, though, didn't mean you were respected. The idea that women should only work in their own homes didn't apply to female ex-slaves after emancipation, who were forced into domestic service or fieldwork. Middle-class women who worked were seen as exceptions, not trailblazers, and their jobs were always minimized with patronizing gendered language, i.e. lady doctor and girl snake oil saleswoman. Okay, I made the second one up. In a popular 1962 survey of 1,800 American housewives conducted by George Gallup, women repeatedly told interviewers that the man should be number one and that they liked it that way. "Apparently," wrote Gallup, "the American woman has all the rights she wants. She's content to know that if she wants to do other things, she can. No one is telling her she can't, and she has made her choice. Not business or politics, but marriage." Hashtag not all women, though. In 1960, Redbook magazine ran an article called "Why Young Mothers Feel Trapped" and invited women to write in, with a $500 prize for best response. They got 24,000 replies, presumably all from women who didn't understand true freedom came from casserole baking. During World War II, more than 3 million jobs were left vacant as men left civilian work for the military. Which reminds me, the military was and remains riddled with inequality. I know, suspend your disbelief. While women had served as nurses in the military since 1901, they were only considered civilian employees and didn't receive a retirement pension or disability if injured in the line of duty. The first woman to enlist was Loretta Walsh in 1917, but it wasn't until 1948 that the Women's Armed Services Integration Act passed, allowing women to serve as permanent, regular members in any of the armed forces, so long as they didn't have kids. It wasn't until 2013 that women were allowed to be in units that took on direct combat, and were still not allowed to join the special forces. After the Second World War, the economy exploded. Even though they made up 6% of the world's population, Americans were producing half the world's goods. Business grew so quickly, the male workforce couldn't keep up. In the 1960s, two-thirds of new jobs went to women. As the 20th century progressed, more women entered the workforce, but again were paid less, as employers took advantage of the assumption that women would only work for a few years before retiring to become wives and mothers. They only offered jobs without health care, pensions, or salaries, positions where there was no opportunity for growth, like researcher or assistant. When the writer Nora Ephron graduated from college, she applied to Newsweek but was told, "Women don't become writers here." Well, everyone knows who Nora Ephron is now. Name one male writer at Newsweek from the 60s. I'll wait. You thinking about the guy with the mustache and the pipe? Right. In a popular board game from the mid-60s, created by the same company that manufactured Scrabble called What Shall I Be? The Exciting Game of Career Girls, the only career options were model, airline hostess, ballet dancer, actress, nurse, and teacher. Winning the game required avoiding negative personality cards, many of which were downright catty. You're never going to be an airline hostess, Becky. Your makeup is too sloppy, and you are overweight. In the mid-century, women flocked to stewardess positions, as they often provided the only chance they'd ever have to travel. What Shall I Be was right. Planes may as well have had no fat chicks bumper stickers on them. Stewardesses were weighed and measured before each flight and let go if they gained a few. A 1966 New York Times classified ad listed the qualifications as, quote, a high school graduate, single, widows and divorcees with no children considered, 20 years of age, girls 19 and a half may apply for future consideration, 5'2", but no more than 5'9", weight 105 to 135 in proportion to height, and have at least 20/40 vision without glasses, end quote. The average tenure was 18 months, thanks to a rule requiring you to quit if you got married. Work was heavily gendered. In 1960, women were 6% of American doctors, 3% of lawyers, and less than 1% of engineers. Those who broke into male-dominated professions were often relegated to low-profile specialties dictated by their sex. Women made up less than one-third of all U.S. employees in 1950. Today they make up almost half, but comprise less than 10% of corporate boards and less than 2% of CEOs. Pay gaps at the lowest and highest levels of income distribution are the largest of all and only widening. Women who have the cushiest jobs experience the biggest wage gap. The better the job, the greater the disparity. It's true, ladies, you really can't have it all. Ah, but what to do with the fraction of men's money you made while toiling? Well, you couldn't go into business without your husband's permission or get credit without a male co-signer until the Equal Credit Opportunity Act of 1974, which made it illegal to refuse credit to a woman based on her gender. Fun fact, the ECOA originally didn't even have a provision banning sex discrimination. Lindy Boggs, the first female congresswoman from Louisiana who got her seat after her husband went missing, no, men's rights activist conspiracy theorist, she didn't have anything to do with his disappearance, added it without consulting the rest of the committee who drafted it, saying, quote, knowing the members composing this committee as well as I do, I'm sure it was just an oversight that we didn't have sex or marital status included. I've taken care of that, and I trust it meets with the committee's approval. They unanimously approved the bill, presumably out of embarrassment for not letting single women be able to finance a fucking Ford Pinto. You've come a long way, baby. If only it were long enough.
Gallup, the man who invented the poll, I guess? Is that who he is?
Yeah, well, I mean, he put his name on it. I'm sure somebody actually made it, and he just slapped his fucking name on it.
Anyway, he said, the American woman has all the rights she wants, and she's made her choice, not business or politics, but marriage.
Mm. Agency.
Yeah, that worked really great for my mother, who was... was one of those women who during World War II got a bunch of jobs in magazines and different kinds of things that because all the men were at war.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the boys came home from war, she lost her jobs and just got married and had kids and spent the entirety of the rest of her life in a simmering rage.
Well, now I know where you get your propensity for simmering rage from.
Yeah, I come by it honestly. It runs in my family for generations.
It's your simmer sauce.
Also, I was interested in that fact that John F. Kennedy, the feminist icon, said he wanted women to be used effectively to provide a better life for our people.
Right.
And by our people, he meant men?
Yeah, I mean, he couldn't just say my boys. I think our people sounds more diplomatic.
I think you're right. Yet another reason why I'm sad he was assassinated. I wish he had lived long enough for us to listen to him dig himself out of that.
I don't know. It's almost like a guy who cheated on his wife like it was his job didn't respect women all that much or something.
All right, so I'm just interested in the fact that apparently you feel that Betty Friedan is in hell.
I mean, maybe.
Oh, listen to you stammering. Well, her book, which was written in 63, is even now way up there on the Amazon numbers in terms of bestsellers. She has a perpetual bestseller. Mm. And she didn't even live long enough to have to deal with the Amazon comments section. So she's never going to know that some guy named Shalom Friedman said, one of those rare books that changes the world. and then gave it 1 star. You know who else didn't really care for her book was somebody named James Cagle.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with him?
I might be.
You might know him. I read the first few pages to humor a feminist family member. If you like this book, you've probably been brainwashed.
You know what? You're right. Betty Friedan is not in hell, because hell is not a tangible place. It's the comment section.
It really is. Mm. Either that, the only thing that could be possibly worse would be being in a room with James Cagle, wherever he is.
I don't want to look him in the eye while he negs me.
No. So in 1864, you are telling me that the fucking Supreme Court ruled that the natural and proper timidity and delicacy which belongs to the female sex unfits it for many of the occupations in life?
Indeed.
That's a quote from the Supreme Court?
The motherfucker unfits itself, yeah.
Jesus. Well, timidity and delicacy are two things I have never been able to pull off. I've never had any luck with either one. So I would have been such a criminal outlaw in 1864. I would have just been standing on street corners screaming, I guess.
Well, who's to say you can't scream on a street corner now?
You are right. You know, I think I'm going to start.
Go for it. I'll hold your purse.
Oh, thanks. Chapter 2, Beauty.
Elizabeth, first queen of England, said to her royal dismay, Raleigh's in Bali just eating tamales while I put his laundry away. Putting the laundry away,
So we're finally embarking on the chapter that I personally have been looking forward to since we started this book, which is my favorite topic, makeup.
Is it because you're trying to sell me Avon? Why are you looking forward to it so much?
I just, you know, it's finally a chapter about women's empowerment, something that women are good at, something that women are interested in. It's the reason that Gaia put us on God's green earth to beautify things.
Oh, it's not to be maritally raped?
No, it's not.
Well, yeah, some women don't get married, but all women buy eyeliner.
Well, you know, that's true. Believe it or not, makeup is what keeps this and every economy bustling. Did you know that the United States is number one internationally in makeup consumption?
We're number one, baby!
Yeah, well, you know, and I personally am really, really happy that the United States is number one at something besides school shootings. In the diary I kept when I was 10, I was very concerned with trying to nail down the exact moment in the future when I would start wearing makeup. I am never wearing lipstick, I announced in my big round handwriting, only to update my opinion 4 more times once I turned 11, starting with, I decided I am not going to wait until I'm 21 to wear lipstick, but will wear it when I'm 18. And ending with, I decided I'm not going to wait until I'm 13 to wear lipstick, but will wear it when I go out to dinner or something at 12. In truth, I didn't really get around to wearing much makeup besides mascara until my late 30s when I got hired as a reporter for local TV. After I began watching myself on video on a regular basis, I realized I better do something. So I hired a makeup artist to teach me how to trowel a few of the preparations everyone else was using onto my face. And from there, it was a mere hop, skip, and a jump to becoming a version of myself so much more neurotic that I'd wake up in the middle of the night and sneak into the bathroom to do a total touch-up, lest the guy I was sleeping with think I didn't look sufficiently fetching even when I was out cold. Using makeup to improve your looks has, for me, always been a very dicey game, especially since I learned that it's possible to look in the mirror before you leave your house, conclude that everything looks fine, then, 15 minutes later, catch a glimpse of yourself in a store window and discover that not only has all your makeup gravitated of its own accord to another location, but now you look the very opposite of fine, by which I mean, in most cases, like a wounded raccoon. And when I say you, I, of course, mean me. So why are women so obsessed with pursuing beauty? And at the same time, such harsh critics of the results? Well, in a world where a woman couldn't vote, was not a citizen, could be sold for pocket change, was locked in the house, etc., etc. Presumably you've heard some of the other chapters of this book. In that world, beauty was one of the few sources of power a woman could access. And at the same time it was viewed with such wariness by the social structure that demanded it, it was almost regarded as a form of treachery. In contemporary psychology, this is known as double binding. I call it, come here, go away. And women have been dealing with it for thousands of years. The ancient Greeks kicked the double binding into high gear with their simultaneous ideas that a beautiful body was proof of a beautiful mind, then following it up with examples like Helen of Troy, who we meet in Book 3 of Homer's Iliad as the old men sing, "Oh, what beauty! Terrible beauty! Like that of a goddess!" before we watch Helen draw men to her bed where they meet their death. Meaning that her magnetic beauty might have looked appealing at first, but actually it was a tool for driving men to their final destruction. Multitasking. The Christians picked up this ball and made touchdowns with it for centuries by calling the duality of beauty and goodness important stations on the soul's path to spiritual purification, while at the same time adding, "Trust not beauty, for it never payeth what it promiseth. A woman is liable to be odious even if she first appears attractive. Makeup ultimately reveals rather than conceals an ugly face," which is the advice found in A Mother's Counsel, a Christian morality book written in 1631. In other words, women have been carefully conditioned to be neurotic about this stuff by being given only one card to play to make your way successfully in the world, and then told there's no good way to play it. So what even is beauty? Well, the ancient Maya in 1000 BC started a tradition of strapping the heads of babies to a board and forcing the skull to become malformed because they worship Yum Cux, the maize god, and therefore felt that faces that resembled an ear of corn were the most beautiful, especially if they had crossed eyes. Then there's Japan from the 8th century straight through the 19th, where somehow women got the idea that the fast track to beauty was through completely black teeth, which they achieved by ingesting dye made of iron filings soaked in tea or sake every day, which means that some of the time at least they got a little buzz. Ancient Egypt gets credit for linking beauty with youth. In fact, Nefertiti, whose name literally means the beautiful woman has arrived, is often used as a model of symmetrical facial features. She was, by the way, 15 when she became queen. The beauty improvement game has been going on for at least 5,000 years, which is when the ancient Sumerians invented lipstick, making it out of a concoction of flowers, red ochre, fish scales, crushed ants, beeswax, and, wait for it, white lead, thus kicking off a long tradition of women and, sometimes men, eager to coat themselves with poisonous ingredients, even after they learned they were harmful. Of course, Greek culture really preferred the male form, going so far as to call women's bodies disfigured versions of men's. You know, the damn Greeks were so hard to please, they were actually harder to please than my mother, and she was impossible. Also, like me and my mom, the Greek women kept right on trying to please them no matter what. They really should have talked to me first. Anyway, because the Greek men favored light complexions, Grecian women began slathering their faces with white lead, and didn't stop just because many deaths by lead poisoning followed. Same way it didn't stop millions of other ladies in dozens of other cultures and centuries from seeking beauty the exact same way. Greece was the first culture to pass laws related to makeup, allowing only prostitutes to legally wear red lipstick in public so they could be easily identified and never confused with respectable women, although this was unlikely to happen in Greece since, as we've learned, respectable women were considered so inferior that the poor Greek men had to lock them in the house. Anyway, makeup continued to be linked to prostitutes for the next 2,000 years, a detail not lost on fetishists. In ancient Rome, the wealthiest women used specially trained makeup and hairstyler slaves to help them apply their red or purplish lip paint, which contained red sulfide of mercury and cinnabar, also a mercury derivative, because everyone knows a great-looking kicky lipstick really should contain at least two kinds of poison. Of course, they also thought that crocodile dung had beautifying and restorative properties for fighting signs of aging. Now, how anyone got the idea of putting crocodile dung on their face in the first place would be a great opening scene in a David Lynch movie. Also, the only good reason I've ever heard for raising your own crocodiles. But add to that the fact that the Romans reportedly gargled with urine to whiten their teeth and freshen their breath. And, you know, actually, the lucky women of ancient Rome spent a lot more time in close proximity to urine than we get to do today. Vessels for collecting it were everywhere on the streets, so passersby could relieve themselves. And when the vats were full of urine, in case you lost track, they were taken straight to a laundry and poured over dirty clothes because they used urine to launder their clothes. So the women got to slash around in it while they did the wash, which I guess means President Trump would have been a happy man in ancient Rome. Not too surprisingly, they also wore copious amounts of perfume, though I have been too terrified to Google what that perfume might have been made of. Naturally, even women wearing perfume created a backlash. The Roman poet Juvenal wrote that a woman buys scents and lotions with adultery in mind. And the philosopher Seneca added that wearing cosmetics was leading to the decline of Roman morality. Not owning slaves, mind you, or forcing them to fight lions. No, that was all fine. It was the scents and the colored lotions. To be fair, there were Romans who wrote essays on the toxic nature of ceruse, the white lead beauty treatment of choice. But the women of Rome could not be dissuaded, even though it was not uncommon for a husband to kiss his wife and find his lips stuck to her face. Perhaps they saw it as some much-needed quality time together. Interestingly, the unibrow was in fashion for a long time, as were long eyelashes, which were thought to be an important indicator of chastity after Roman philosopher Pliny the Elder wrote that eyelashes only fell out due to excessive sex. This continued until the Renaissance, when women were informed that actually Pliny had that backwards. It was the long eyelashes themselves that were a symbol of excessive sex. So women shrugged, took that note, and plucked their eyelashes out. As is usually the case, the wealthy had an easier way of life. Unless you were the beauty-seeking Empress Poppy Sabina, wife of the Emperor Nero, who apparently employed 100 attendants to maintain her looks and keep her lips painted at all times. Ah, how she enjoyed her daily milk baths, which she believed helped dispel diseases and blights, until, according to historian Suetonius, while awaiting the birth of her second child in the summer of 65, despite her perfect makeup, she quarreled with Nero over his spending much too much time at the races, which was a fair point, I thought, because who wouldn't want to spend more time with Nero? And apparently he wasn't too pleased with the arguments she used, so he kicked her to death, as one does. Which brings us to the most inspiring of the Roman female vanity stories. The day women's vanity actually kicked off a political movement. Lex Appia was a group of laws passed by the Roman Senate during a financial crisis after the Second Punic War. Part of their effect was to severely curb female spending by putting limits on how much gold women could wear, while also forbidding women from wearing multicolored garments and riding in carriages within 1 mile of the city. In a society where a woman was completely under the control of her father and husband, new restrictions on showing status and identity through personal adornment felt like the last straw. Of course, when women banded together to finally make their voices heard, it scared the shit out of the male politicians. Because we have not kept our women individually under control, we now dread them collectively, said Roman Senator Cato the Elder, warning the men that it would be a slippery slope from repealing limits on wives' spending to them interfering with all kinds of other legislation. But the protesting women did the unthinkable. They approached men on the streets and asked them for their votes. Then they followed up with a demonstration so intense that in 195 BC, 20 years after these Lex Appia laws were passed, they succeeded in getting them revoked. Of course, by the time the Roman Empire itself crumbled, a few hundred years later, church officials were back, hard at work, spreading the word that any woman who wore makeup was an incarnation of Satan. Which brings us to the Middle Ages, where, you know, everything was fine. Nothing wacky ever went on in the Middle Ages. Sure, there are stories about how as many as 400 women a day were being put to death for witchcraft, leaving one of the most important states in the Holy Roman Empire with two villages that had only one remaining female inhabitant each. Meanwhile, over in Italy, the Renaissance had kicked in, creating a time of great art by male artists, who, oddly enough, were the only ones whose work was recorded by history. It was also a time for these great male artists, poets, and philosophers to do the important work of settling down very specific guidelines for female physical perfection. Fortunately, they were able to do this in enough painstaking detail to make sure that every woman from that point forward would have a vivid picture of all her physical inadequacies. Examples: the mouth should be on the small side, neither too angular nor too flat, and when open, only 5 or 6 of the upper teeth should be revealed, even and gleaming white, joined to the gums by a reddish band. And the shell of the ear should be finely turned and of a livelier tint than the flat part. So remember, don't go thinking you can just overlook the tint of the finely turned ear shell, ladies. Large, hairless, curved, gleaming foreheads were part of this picture, causing cooperative women to begin plucking and shaving their hairlines and removing their eyebrows. As you may recall, their eyelashes were already gone. So, by 1558, when the notably redheaded Elizabeth I took the throne at the age of 25, she knew what she must do. She was already a woman who eschewed marriage because she didn't want to lose her autonomy, so she knew damn well she better differentiate herself from her mother, Anne Boleyn, who'd been accused of witchcraft, and her sister, who was known as Bloody Mary. Thus, Elizabeth I put a lot of her money on the one card she knew she could safely play to make herself into an inspiring, larger-than-life icon. Beauty. Step 1, erasing the scars left on her face from childhood smallpox with Cerulean, that finely ground white lead makeup base that everyone loved because it covered all kinds of scars completely. To brighten the artificial pallor, she added a popular shade of bright red lipstick called Vermilion, containing cinnabar, which of course was mercury-based. And she finished it off with a glaze made of painted egg whites, taking care to stay out of the sun, lest the members of her court begin to hand her plates of toast cut on the diagonal because they mistook her for the number 3 breakfast at Denny's. Naming this look the Mask of Youth, she believed it had the ability to ward off death. And it was not just well received. Soon everyone was doing it. To imitate her red gold hair, they used a dye made from, what else? Quicklime, sulfur, and lead. Okay, maybe it caused headaches, nausea, and serious nosebleeds, but what a perfect new twist on the more old-fashioned symptoms of a standard lead poisoning. Eventually, Elizabeth I died with a half inch of lead caked on her face. A half inch! Think about that. That's thicker than the frosting on a greedy child's birthday cake. Though before checkout time, she was still able to summon the energy to add coloring to a plaster of Paris mixture, shape it into a crayon, and invent the lip pencil. Sadly, she neglected to go the distance and add at least a little cyanide. After her death, the church couldn't wait to get back to the business of treating lipstick as a morality issue again, so they began passing laws that claimed it was not just sinful and a sign of witchcraft, but also deceitful to men, and you can't have that. Philip Stubbs, a man of this period who should have kept his big mouth shut more, wrote a book in 1585 called Anatomy of Abuses, in which he said things like, "Saint Cyprian saith, a woman, through painting and dyeing her face, hath corrupted and defaced like a filthy strumpet the workmanship of God by turning truth into falsehood with painting and slibber sauces." On the bright side, the word slibber sauces. And speaking of slibber sauces, a popular 16th century facial mask for gals was worn for 8 days straight. The simple recipe consisted of eggs, vinegar, sugar, camphor, rack alum, quicksilver, lemon juice, tartar, white onion, and, of course, turpentine. Welcome to Ground Zero for men of letters complaining that it took their women way too long to get ready. The mask had to be steamed to be removed. And also, it left the skin so sensitive you couldn't go out into the sunlight. But that was easily fixed by wearing a vizard mask, a spooky-looking oval mask of black velvet with weird little cut-out eye and mouth holes. It was the kind of thing that was really perfect to wear to a serial killing. It was held in place by grasping a bead which was attached to its back between your teeth. The mask added to feminine mystery, people said, and brought a welcome end to pointless small talk. And it probably also provided much-needed relief from listening to your friends all whine about how much their skin hurt. By now, drawings and paintings of devils putting lipstick on women were appearing everywhere. Plus, women had to mention lipstick use when they went to confession, eventually leading our cultural ancestors, the Puritans, to conclude that cosmetics were worse than adultery. Though it's certainly a toss-up which of these two fun things caused the most disease. Cut to the end of the 1700s, when an estimated 400,000 Europeans were dying of smallpox every year. So naturally the survivors, aware they'd somehow been lucky enough to beat death, ran as fast as they could to buy something poisonous to cover the pockmarks. Poison schmoisen. This was the all-new improved lead, now with horse manure and vinegar. Okay, yes, the staff who made the stuff suffered from cramps, headaches, dizziness, constipation, hair loss, tremors, loose teeth, and occasional blindness. But no one could dispute how flawless their skin looked right before they croaked. Around this time, cleavage came back into fashion, which one writer of the period described as the most fashionable bosom, scabrous with inflammation, to which the female lead addicts probably all replied in unison, Tell me something I don't know. Scabrous is totally what I was going for. And to prove it, worked diligently to add a layer of faux reality by carefully drawing realistic-looking blue veins on their foreheads and breasts to make their skin appear legitimately translucent. Ah, the beauty trends of the 1700s. It's impossible to say enough good things about the new glued-on artificial eyebrows made of mice, which sadly fell off, but still managed to inspire